minor factor. And the bow tie antenna is one of the very nice variations of building a large equivalent diameter. Every one of us can build a dipole out of simple wire, like a 14-gauge wire, 132 feet long. It's a beautiful half-wave dipole at 80 meters. But the diameter of that wire in wavelength is so small that that's a very sharp antenna in beamwidth. It's not going to give you 2-to-1 Vizslar across the whole 3.5 to 4.2 megahertz. It would give you that bandwidth if you could make it larger in diameter. The bowtie antenna is a very large diameter dipole. Even though it's flat or it's got a slight curvature to it, the RF cannot tell the difference between that flat sheet and a cone of approximately the same dimensions. It thinks it's a fat radiator, if you know what I mean. The RF energy doesn't look at those fine details. It just looks at the apparent width, apparent cross-sectional area, so to speak. So a bow tie can give you some beautiful bandwidth, reasonably low standing wave ratio, not quite the bandwidth of a log periodic, but it's a lot simpler. So that's some of the answer. So chapter four, or it's not chapter four, stand by. It's a so-called chapter on reflector antennas. I think I've got a copy of that book in the bookshelf with me here. So as you go to your next question, John, I may be able to find the exact chapter number, but the chapter that's labeled reflector antennas will show you the exact beamwidth, in other words, the real plotted beamwidth of corner reflectors of various diameters, and the slight variation you get when you make the corner reflector two sheets 60 degrees apart as opposed to 90 degrees apart. You can now make the sheets a little bit bigger before the gain starts falling off. In the case of a corner reflector, if you just simply increase the size of the corner reflector, made those sheets bigger and bigger, at first the gain would increase. Eventually, because you're getting such a large number of wavelengths, where you're starting to get a significant error between that simple plot of a corner reflector superimposed on a parabolic curve, when you start getting a very large number of wavelengths, the error builds up, and pretty soon as you make the corner reflector very large, you don't get any further gain increase, whereas with a parabolic reflector, you would. That's some of the information on corner reflector antennas fed with a bow tie, dipole-like structure. There's quite a bit more to it, but that'll scratch the surface, I think, John. KC2, WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
K2, WGB. Very good, Dick. Now, in that calculation you gave, the area that you're concerned with is only the radiating element, right? Not the area of the screen?
Now, very, very glad you asked that question, John. No, it's the area of the screen. In the case of a parabolic reflector, you may have to readjust the curvature in order to make it bigger and bigger, but if I had a simple dipole as the feed horn, so to speak, for a parabolic reflector, and as I make the parabolic reflector get bigger and bigger, the gain will continue to increase. The gain, the formula I gave you, number of wavelengths of width tells you the horizontal beam width. Number of wavelengths of height tells you the vertical beam width. You divide those number of wavelengths into 70 degrees, gives you an extremely good approximation as to what is the beam width. If you now take that, the next step, take the horizontal beam width and the vertical beam width and multiply the two together, you could call that the total number of square degrees of your main lobe. Divide that into 35,000. That is the gain of your antenna. If you know the horizontal beamwidth, I told you how to calculate it. You know the vertical beamwidth, I told you how to calculate it. Multiply them together, divide it by 35,000. That is the gain of your antenna. That's a high number. Take 10 times the log of that, and you will know the gain in decibels. Another very good approximation. So if somebody told you the horizontal and vertical beamwidth of your antenna, I just told you how to calculate its gain. Again, it's going to have a couple of percent of error, but it's close enough. It's well inside the ballpark, if you know what I mean. Not quite at home plate, somewhere between the pitcher's mound and home plate. Well inside the ballpark, good enough approximation. So it's the reflector diameter. When your feed horn, or your dipole, so to speak, let me drop. When your your dipole is doing its radiating. The signal coming out of it in the near field really is a spherical wave front. The phase front of that signal radiated by your dipole is spherical. When you get a large number of wavelengths beyond it, because that spherical wavelength, because that sphere is continuously expanding at the speed of light, it eventually becomes almost planar. The magic of a parabolic reflector is it takes that spherical wavefront of your dipole, converts it into a pure planar wavefront, where you get maximum directivity and maximum gain. So, calculating gain, it's the size of the mouth of the horn, it's the size of the reflector you're using, as long as you haven't violated the rules. In the case of a corner reflector, you're not going to do it with 1,000 wavelengths. You're going to do it with a few wavelengths, and it's close enough to a parabolic surface. So I'm awful glad you asked that question, John. KC2WGB, K2RW in the deck net.
K2WGB, not to drag this on, but one further question. Now, I can see that, and he can see that in the flat plane. What happens when you fold that reflector, say at 90 degrees, do you use the total square inches or square millimeters of it, or do you have to make an adjustment for that?
First of all, when it comes to the diameter of the radiating surface, so to speak, of the antenna, I told you, don't use the dipole, you use the reflector. And so if the reflector is parabolic, the answer is exact. If the reflector is a 90 degree corner reflector, it's close enough. If the reflector is a simple flat sheet, that's the one place where you don't use this rule. A simple flat sheet really is the poor man's equivalent of a phased array. It's called a Yagi with two elements. By that I mean you've got the real element in front of the flat sheet. You have the mirror image of that element behind the flat sheet. If you now took two elements of two dipoles and properly fed them, and you compared the gain of those two dipoles properly fed as opposed to one dipole in front of a flat sheet, it would be the same. Close enough, if you know what I mean. I mean, damn close to the same. So the flat sheet is just giving you another element where you don't have to bother building a power divider and properly phasing it and whatever. The flat sheet does it very nicely. That's when you've got one dipole in front of a flat sheet. You get the exact same gain as a two-element Yagi, so to speak, where both elements are being fed. So that's the one case where you don't use the size of the sheet. Unless, now went the next step. You decided to build a great big sheet, and in order to properly illuminate that sheet, you made it a 2x2 array of dipoles, too wide, too high. And that also was an extremely popular UHF television receiving antenna in the old days. Let me drop. So you could make that sheet, that flat sheet, as big as you like, as long as there's approximately a half wave or three-quarter wave spacing between all the dipoles that are horizontally displaced and vertically displaced. You're now lighting up that whole sheet. You could say that one simple dipole in front of a sheet only lights up an area or maybe three-quarters of a wavelength in diameter. The rest of it doesn't do a great deal, unless you got more dipoles out there. So you get this beautiful conversion of curvature of field coming out of a dipole, reflecting off something, becoming a beautiful planar wavefront when that reflector is parabola or a corner reflector. If it's a flat sheet, now you've got to put more dipoles across there if you're going to make that sheet as big as you'd like to get a whole lot of gain. So there's two different ways of making a planar wavefront. A big sheet with a whole bunch of dipoles across it. You know, 2, 3, 4 wide, 2, 3, 4 high. That's one way to do it. Or the parabola is the sophisticated way to do it. And a corner reflector is a poor man's equivalent. Does that make a little more sense, though, John? Glad you're asking these questions. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, thanks for that explanation. That basically covers what he was asking. So I know he's actually building these things, so I hope he comes back and lets me know how he makes out. All right, if you want to look good in the book or you want to go on to the next one, whatever you wish to do.
Let's go to the next question, John.
Okay, another antenna question. All right. This gentleman is working with the frequency is 200 megahertz, and he has a vertical with radials, and it is resonant at that frequency. Now, he wants to know, it's a quarter wave, by the way. Now, does that automatically become a half wave at 400 megahertz, and what happens to the function of the radials? Maybe you can give him some tips on that and why that may not work out exactly. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think we're now talking about the series of quarter wave ground plane antennas. A typical quarter wave ground plane antenna can consist of a quarter wave rod sticking out of the top of the sheet metal of the center of my car, for instance. Okay, you don't have to lay down radials, the sheet metal of the car does it for you. If you're now putting that antenna on top of a tower, the typical design is going to have three or four radials at the base, quarter wavelength long each. And if you made them straight out, flat, the antenna would have an impedance close to 35 ohms. By slanting those four radials, three or four radials down, at something like a 30 or 45 degree angle, now the antenna goes from something like 35 degrees impedance to closer to 50 degrees impedance. So it's easier to match it. And that gives you a vertical beam width of approximately 85 or so degrees, similar to a dipole, and it gives you a horizontal beam width that's 360, it goes all the way around. That's if you're feeding it at the fundamental frequency. If I now feed it at twice that frequency, I'm on the second harmonic, let me drop. Life gets a little bit complicated when you do that, because you take a quarter wave resonator, and let me backtrack. The most basic antenna is a dipole. You could say that a dipole is a pair of quarter wave ground planes back to back. I could take your dipole, I could put an infinite sheet of metal right down the center of the dipole at right angles to the wire with a small hole in that sheet of metal where the dipole goes through. I could put a sheet of metal there because the dipole at every instant of time is a symmetrical device. In other words, at the instant when the right hand side is positive, the left hand side is negative, that sheet of metal is at the neutral plane. Putting that sheet of metal there changes nothing about the impedance or the pattern, or the gain. Nothing changes when you put the sheet of metal there. Now, once I've got that sheet of metal in the middle of my dipole at right angles to the wire, I can throw away the left-hand side of the dipole and feed only the right-hand side. The left-hand side is there now as a mirror image in that sheet of metal. We call that a ground plane. So an ideal ground plane would be a quarter-wave resonator above an infinite sheet of metal. The sheet of metal doesn't have to be infinite. Making it a quarter-wavelength long, making it out of three or four radials, close enough, very close to the same gain and pattern. When you now go to the frequency, your wave is wave long. And if you go to the Brown and Woodward curves, by that I mean these curves that tell you what impedance you're going to get out of any antenna when you know the diameter of the radiator and the length of the radiator. Let me drop. The so-called Brown and Woodward curves are in Chapter 4 of every one of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And now, Mike and Mike have given them to you free of charge. If you go to Mike number 1, which is amateurradio.tangovictor, and you go to the article by K2RIW, Perfect Impedance Matching of a Dipole, or of a Yagi, I think it is, and you go to that article, at that website, you will get these set of curves. Or if you go to Mike number 2's website, which is LimarcTechnet.com, LimarcTechnet.com, and again you will see this article by K2RIW where these two curves are there. These two curves tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get for essentially any antenna that is wire-like. You tell me the diameter of the wire, which the curve asks for the A to D ratio. That really means diameter to length ratio. You take the diameter to length ratio, which might be 1,000 to 1, and you go to that particular curve. And the horizontal axis is the length of wire, and the vertical axis is impedance. Let me drop. And what's the magic about Mr. Brown and Woodward is that in roughly 1945, I think they were working for Bell Labs at the time, they took the best instrumentation you could get your hands on at that time. They spent roughly a man year measuring the exact impedance of every diameter and every length of wire you're likely to use. Real data. You try to write a formula that does that, difficult as all hell. they measured the real thing. So once you know the diameter of your wire, and even though the wire is not constant in diameter, there's another set of curves that Brown and Woodward did for you. But the main curves are, you know, constant diameter wire, once you know the length, and the length is rated not in inches, it's rated in degrees. A quarter wavelength wire is so-called 90 degrees long. So the horizontal axis goes from 0 to 180 degrees, or it goes 0 to 360 degrees. So there's two curves. One curve tells you what is the resistive component of the impedance. The other curve tells you what the reactive component is. If the reactive component is negative, we call it capacitive. If the reactive component is positive, we call it inductive. And the equivalent circuit of your dipole usually is a series component, a resistor in series with a reactor. And you feed, you put them together and bring the two ends around, and that's your feed terminals, if you know what I mean. Every dipole-like antenna could resemble, at each frequency where you use your dipole, you can represent it electronically. Let me drop. You can represent it electronically as a resistor in series with a capacitor, or a resistor in series with an inductor, depending on whether you're above or below the quarter wave resonant point. And those two curves give you the exact answer. That's the way your dipole will act as far as the transmission line is concerned. That tells you what impedance you're going to see, what standing wave ratio you're going to get. Let me think now, where was that going with this? What was the original question, John? Something about that. Oh, yes. This ground plane antenna. When I now go to the place where it is not a quarter wavelength long, it's not 90 degrees long on those curves, it's now 180 degrees long. You're going to see that the resistive component, which at a quarter wave long was something in the vicinity of 35 ohms, half of the 70 ohms of a full dipole, this is a monopole, you know, ground plane, the 35 ohms is going to go to some ridiculously high number, like 1,500 ohms. So that when you're feeding a half wavelength antenna at one end instead of the center, you feed a half wavelength antenna in the center, you see 72 ohms. You feed it at one of the outer ends, you see something like 1,500 ohms. That's going to give you an extremely high standing wave ratio. Let me think now. That's I think it's like a 1,500 divided by 50. I think that's something like a 25 to 1 standing wave ratio. It's a big number. And so that impedance-wise, it's a problem. Antenna radiation-wise, it's not bad. A half-wavelength antenna gives you a beautiful broadside radiation, gives you a little bit more gain than a quarter-wave antenna. The pattern doesn't change a whole lot, but the impedance is going to change a huge amount. You're going to have to do something, like using an antenna tuner or putting in an L network or whatever, to get a good impedance match when you're on twice the frequency. Let me drop. If you now go the next step, if you go to three times the frequency, where your radiating system is now three times a quarter wavelength long, impedance-wise, it comes back to the 50-ohm region. That's the good news. The bad news is that now something that's three-quarters of a wavelength long, let me think, three-quarters of a wavelength long, it now has a more complicated elevation pattern. And the peak of the gain is not on the horizon. As you slowly raise the length of an antenna, in other words, wavelength-wise, you can make your antenna larger and larger number of wavelengths by doing two things. Really stretching the antenna as if it was a telescoping radiator. In other words, you actually stretch the real antenna, or you go to a higher frequency. In either case, electronically, you've made the antenna longer in wavelengths or longer in degrees of phase angle, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. And lots of people have done that experiment. You take a quarter wave resonator, quarter wave radiator, and you make it longer and longer, and you keep impedance matching it. You'll find out that you get the maximum gain on the horizon at 5/8 wavelength. 5/8 wavelength, you get maximum gain on the horizon. As you go to 3/4 wavelength, you start developing a null on the horizon. You haven't developed the null yet. The null is not there until, I think it's a full wavelength long. Yes, a full wavelength long, you have a null on the horizon. You have a peak above the horizon and a peak below the horizon. So at 5/8 wave, you get maximum gain on the horizon. At 3/4 wave, you've now fell off to a lower amount of gain than you had with the quarter wave. So you've got a good impedance match. You you may not like the pattern, unless you want to radiate a signal both above and below the horizon. If you're mounting the antenna on top of the Empire State Building, and one of those lobes is below the horizon, and you're talking to somebody 10 miles away, that could be the ideal antenna. So, complicated things happen. And by the way, when you look at those Brown and Woodward curves, let me drop it. The first thing that'll strike you, if you know what you're looking at, is that at a quarter wavelength of length, the ground plane, infinite ground plane, quarter wave radiator has approximately 35 ohms of resistive component. As you go, and at exactly a quarter wavelength, the reactive component is zero. There's no reactance. The equivalent circuit is a resistor in series with a reactor. Well, the reactor is going to be 0 ohms of reactance. It's not there, if you know what I mean. As you go a little bit above or a little bit below in frequency, or correspondingly, you make the radiator a little bit longer or a little bit shorter than a quarter wave. As you look at those curves, you'll see that the reactive component builds up real fast. The reactive component has got a very steep vertical slope to it. The reactive component changes at least 10 times, maybe it's 30 times faster than the resistive component. As you make the length longer and shorter in wavelength, the resistive component changes very slowly. The reactive component changes extremely fast. Therefore, whenever your antenna is non-resonant, you're above or below the resonant frequency, so to speak, and you start building up a VSWR real fast. The VSWR told you the antenna is not a good impedance match. Let me drop it. Well, resistively, the 35 ohms that you started off with is maybe 34 or 36 ohms. It changes very slowly. The reactive component starts building up real fast. So a non-resonant antenna is an antenna that's got reactants. If you're willing to compensate for the reactants, in other words, if the antenna is a little bit longer than a quarter wave, which means it's inductive, and you put a capacitor in series with that antenna, the radiator, to calculate, to cancel the inductive component, you're converting back to the 35 or 36 ohms, if you know what I mean. So that a non-resonant antenna has almost always excessive reactants. You could now turn it around backwards. If I force my antenna to be resonant, what have I done? I've removed the reactive component. I've either put an impedance matching network in there to remove the reactive component, or I've changed the length so it's the right length so that there is no reactive component, like 90 degrees of length. So making an antenna resonating is a fancy way of saying I'm getting rid of the reactive component of its impedance. So this gives you some of what's going to happen. So in general, without having loading coils and other things, other doodads in your antenna, let me drop it. Most of the time, you're not going to be completely happy if you feed your quarter wave ground plane at some other frequency. Now, if I have a 2 meter quarter wave ground plane and I feed it on 432, without a doubt, I'm going to talk to repeaters, I'm going to talk to people. If I plot the antenna pattern, where it's now 3/4 wavelengths long, I'll find out I don't have quite as strong a lobe on the horizon. The main lobe is now above or below the horizon. It's not a showstopper. It's just less than ideal. But a 2 meter antenna fed on 432, impedance-wise, it's not too bad. Radiation-wise, it's not too bad. Pattern-wise, it's not too bad. It's just not completely ideal. Lots of us have done it. It works like a charm. Quite often in the past, I've used a 2 meter ground plane on 432, because the 432 antenna up there needed repair. I got away with it. So, it does work. Is this some of what you think the guy is looking for with this question, John? KC2WGB, our mailbag expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, his problem was he believes that if it is a particular length at a certain frequency, if you double the frequency, you're going to have twice the length. That's the way he was looking at it. He didn't realize the complication of the reactive component, and that's what you just explained to him, which I'm sure he understands now. Interesting stuff.
Let me give you a couple more words on that. As you start going above or below the so-called resonant frequency, where the radiator was approximately a quarter wavelength long, and you go above or below that frequency, you start building up reactive component real fast. The magic that happens at exactly twice the frequency is the reactive component again goes back to zero. At exactly twice the frequency, the resistive component goes up to 1500 ohms. So if you plotted reactive component versus frequency, it's a cyclic phenomena. Roughly 0 degrees, zero ohms of reactance at quarter wave, roughly, and the reactive component goes to zero, but the resistive component gets super high at twice the wavelength. At three quarters of the wavelength, again, it comes back down to a non-reactive component. So it's a cyclic thing every quarter wave. Now, there are ways of putting the right kind of a loading coil in the middle of your radiator so that you can make a quarter wave ground plane-like antenna, which is specifically designed to have good impedance and good pattern at 432 and 2 meters simultaneously. You can buy dual-band ground plane antennas. So by putting the loading coil in the right place, loading coil, maybe there's a capacitor in there also, in the right place along that radiator, you can make a dual-band and maybe even a tri-band antenna, where now the impedance is right and the pattern is right at both of those frequencies. But if you didn't do that, and you simply feed a 2-meter ground plane on 450, it'll work like a charm. You'll have a little bit higher visual. The pattern is not quite ideal, but 90% of the guys you want to talk to are going to hear you as if you had an antenna designed for that frequency. So a 3-to-1 relationship, things come back to normal. A 2-to-1 frequency relationship, without doing something special.
Repeater, timeout.
2-to-1 doesn't work so well. If I took a 144 meg antenna and I set it on 288, I'd be seeing 1500 ohms. That's an extremely high visual. If I now go to 3 times the frequency, 450, the impedance comes right back down again. The pattern's a little bit less than ideal. So many antennas work very well on a 3-to-1 and a 5-to-1 relationship frequency-wise. But the second harmonic and the fourth harmonic, the impedance is pretty terrible because the resistive component goes to numbers like 1500. Those are good things to remember as rules of thumb. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
DC2WGB. Very good, Dick. You know, that's one of the wonderful things about, I don't know if he has a network analyzer, but you can take a network analyzer, as you know, and you just put a fitting there and put a little telescoping antenna with a moderate ground plane and, you know, pick a frequency. And as you extend that antenna, you can watch all of those components, the reactive component and the resistive component, and you can see that relationship. It makes it so much easier to visualize exactly what's happening. But good stuff. Too bad they're just so damn expensive. I don't know if he has one, but I know he could use that, and he could play with a simple telescope antenna. I'm sure you've done the same thing. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, arguably the Cadillac of test equipment is a vector network analyzer. You can have it display for yourself a Smith chart, which now gives you all the impedance as a simple dot on that screen. As you sweep in frequency, it draws a line on the screen telling you the exact impedance you're going to get at every frequency. Not everyone feels comfortable with the Smith chart. I understand that. You can also flip the knobs on your vector network analyzer so that it gives you two separate curves as a XY plot, as a rectangular plot, frequency horizontal and impedance vertical. And you can make one curve blue, which is the resistive component, and the other curve yellow or red, which is the reactive component. You can plot those two curves. And so with that vector network analyzer, it will sweep across any frequencies you want and tell you the exact impedance that you're going to get at every frequency. There's a poor man's equivalent of that. Good job. As long as your antenna analyzer is working well, your antenna analyzer will tell you what is the resistive component and what is the reactive component at each frequency you go to. Therefore, you could manually draw a dot, or you could put the data into a spreadsheet and have it plot the curve for you. So, an antenna analyzer is a poor man's equivalent of a vector network analyzer. It gives you one set of data, resistive component and reactive component, at each individual frequency you're killing your transmitter too. So, and a network analyzer, I mean an antenna analyzer, I think some of those are in the $150, $200 category. Whereas a good vector network analyzer, I don't think you can get very much quality for less than $3,000, $5,000. So, an antenna analyzer is a vector network analyzer. It just works one frequency at a time, as opposed to sweeping across frequencies and doing all the calculations and displaying it on your favorite kind of graph. So you can still get that data. You just have to spend some more man hours doing it. You could say that's exactly what Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward did in roughly 1945. Let me drop the instruments they were using in those days. They didn't even have something anywhere near as good as an antenna analyzer. They did it all with a signal generator, frequency meter, slotted line, careful calculations, on a slide rule. What they were doing was a hell of a lot slower than what you could do today using an antenna analyzer at each particular frequency. The antenna analyzer will directly tell you the resistive component and the reactive component at the frequency you're now tuned to. Your antenna analyzer will give that to you. When you're using what they were using in those days, the signal generator they had would be always drifting and the dial wasn't very accurate. So you had a frequency meter after the signal generator telling you what frequency you're on. You applied that signal to a slotted line. The output of the slotted line went to the antenna on the test. And now you move the carriage on the slotted line and you measured the peaks and valleys that tells you the magnitude of the visuar. You then measured the location in centimeters of where was the nulls. That tells you the phase angle. With a whole bunch of calculating on a slide rule, you now calculated how many centimeters the nulls moved from the calibration point. That tells you the phase angle. And the peak to valley tells you the magnitude of the standing wave ratio. And with a bunch of calculations, you can now boil that down to the resistive component and the reactive component. So those curves, that when we look at them, you're looking at a man's year's worth of work to do that at all the frequencies, at all the lengths, and all the diameters of the antennas that they tested. What a huge amount of work. Let me drop. From that time forward, a number of people have tried to come up with an equation that tells you the impedance of a simple dipole versus frequency. And in the appropriate chapter of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, you will see that equation. It's very complicated. And when you read carefully, the equation said it only works within a few percent of the resonant frequency of the antenna. And you go beyond that point, the equation breaks down, it doesn't work. There's a hell of a lot of people have fallen into the trap of looking at that equation and say, hey, that's the equation of a dipole. They plug it into their computer and they plot from DC to light. 98% of all the data they got is garbage because the equation doesn't work there. They forgot to remember the caveat that's alongside of the equation. It only works within a few percent of the resonant frequency. The real total equation of dipole impedance versus frequency, if there was such an equation, it would look like an infinite series. It would have a huge number of terms. Nobody in his right mind would try to write that equation. Mr. Brown and Woodward, with ham radio type, you know, grip, pure elbow labor, they went and measured the real numbers. The hell with calculating an equation that fits it, they measured the real data. Use it. That data comes straight from the horse's mouth. It's traceable to the Bureau of Standards. I have used that the set of curves. Let me drop it. I have had my own consulting business for the last 16 years, and an awful lot of that was doing consulting antenna design, most of it at 915 megacycles for RFID readers. And those Brown and Woodward curves, man, have I made a lot of use out of those. And what amazes the daylights out of me is that when I talk to professional antenna engineers at many companies, and I mention the Brown and Woodward curves, I get a blank stare. All the education they have had did tell them that these extremely valuable equations, valuable curves, are sitting there in plain sight ever since 1945. Every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, all four editions, have had them. And the average engineer has not been taught in his classes how valuable those curves are. And they try to get around that problem by various techniques. Any one of us who's building an antenna, we know something about what diameter of wire you're going to use, what length of wire you're going to use, and if you want to know the method by which you're going to feed it, let me drop it. Once you've chosen the method, you're going to feed it. If it's a dipole-like structure, you're going to feed it in the center, you're going to feed it at the outer edge, you're going to feed it halfway between the two, whatever. Those curves tell you the exact impedance you're going to get, because those guys went and really measured it. The equation to predict that would be crazy. The real data is relatively simple if you know it's there. And it's a well-kept secret. Make sure you don't tell anybody. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, not too many people realize how much work that was, Dick, those two gentlemen did. You know, they didn't have the slotted line like you and I have. They were using a length of wire with a meter stick. And also the probes, the frequency meter, not frequency counter, which had to run constant calibration at certain temperatures, and they did some accurate work under some horrendous conditions. So, absolutely, what a great job, and look at the years they did that in. Wow, antiquity. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my next one. Okay, they're quite weak this week. This is the last one. This young student was having a conversation with his high school science teacher, and he was trying to explain that he listens to the TechNet, and they were talking about the communications with the distant satellites and vehicles that we've sent to, like, Pluto and traveling all over, Voyager. And he was trying to explain to the teacher that the problem is, under some conditions, because of the signal handling, they have to slow the bit rate down because it just can't handle it. And his teacher did not understand that and basically didn't believe him, because the RF wave is the same. Why would they have to slow the bit rate down? So I know he's listening tonight, so maybe you can give a quick explanation to that, and we will be complete. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If I started off with my 20-meter dipole, for instance, and on a good day when the ionosphere is doing its normal thing and I'm hearing signals from all Europe and Africa, for instance, and I make a measurement, I would find out that the amount of noise coming in my antenna, during the time there was no signal, I go to a certain frequency in the band where nobody is there. Maybe I'm doing it at 2 o'clock in the morning. But I measure the amount of noise power coming out of my antenna. You'll find out that it's the equivalent of something like a 30 decibel noise figure. If I made a very poorly designed RF low noise amplifier, a really good one would have 1 dB of noise figure. A really bad one would have 30 dB of noise figure. In other words, there's something less than ideal about the amplifying stage of my low noise amplifier, that it's making excess noise that tends to cover up the signals I want to listen to. You can easily make a really bad antenna, a really bad amplifier with a high noise figure. Just don't properly tune it, for instance. Or use a defective transistor where somebody has zapped the front end of the thing with strong signals, and you can get high noise figure. Let me drop it. So therefore, when it comes to listening to weak signals on 20 meters, the noise of the ionosphere, the noise of the atmosphere, dominates. The solar wind is hitting all of those ozone particles in the ionosphere, heating them up, and they're making a hell of a lot of noise. The good news is the signal reflects off the ionosphere, and you can hear Europe. Even though Europe is way beyond Earth curvature 10 times over. But you can hear Europe because of the reflection of the ionosphere. That's the good news. The bad news is the ionosphere is a plasma that, electronically speaking, it's acting like something that's at 10,000 degrees Kelvin. It's a hot plasma making radio noise. So therefore, that signal from Europe that you would like to listen to, 99.9% of the time, it is always there. However, the noise of the ionosphere dominates it, covers up that signal, until the ionosphere is giving you an ideal bounce, acting like a mirror, so to speak, an ideal couple of bounces. Then that signal from Europe gets to you, and it's above the noise. So noise is something we're always fighting. When you get up to microwave frequencies, when you've got a very high gain parabolic dish antenna in your ground station, and maybe we're talking about the 240-foot diameter dish at Goldstone, California, and I've been there. Beautiful piece of hardware. Let me drop. That thing has got a very small fraction of 1 degree of beam width, and you aim it out into space, and it is looking at a cold sky where the sky temperature, according to Mr. Penzias and Mr. Wilson, who got a Nobel Prize for doing that in 1967, they measured the amount of radio noise left over from the Big Bang. So at a microwave frequency, like 10 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz, the sky noise is 3 degrees Kelvin, not 10,000 degrees Kelvin, like we've got at 20 megahertz, about 20 meters. So now you still have noise, but a hell of a lot less of it. And your preamplifier in front of that receiver you're using connected to the Goldstone, I think that runs something like 10 degrees Kelvin, a cryogenically cooled amplifier, very low noise. And so every signal you ever want to listen to, no matter how weak it is, let me drop this. No matter how weak the signal is, and by the way, every signal, no matter where it comes from, no matter what conditions you're listening to it under, even though you think you've nulled it out because you've got two antennas 180 degrees out of phase, if you know what I mean, aimed in that direction, no matter what you do to make a signal weak, you can never make it go to zero. That's a hard one to accept. No signal ever goes to zero. It becomes weak as all hell. I can make a null that's 50 dB deep, but that's not zero. That's just 50 dB is 1/100,000. I can make it 100,000 times weaker by making a 50 decibel null. That is not zero. You give me enough amplification, I can take that signal that's weak as all hell, amplify it correctly, and I can listen to it. But there's a catch. Every signal you've ever listened to, whether it's beating against the noise of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, 3 degrees Kelvin, added to the back lobe noise of your antenna has always got a certain gain to temperature ratio. That 240-foot dish at Goldstone, California, with that beautiful fraction of a degree beam was aimed at Voyager, for instance. Let me drop. That antenna may have a 40 dB front to back ratio, but that back lobe, 40 dB down, is 180 degrees wide and is looking at the hot earth below that antenna. So there's some amount of noise coming into the back lobe of that nearly ideal antenna. So you've got 3 degrees Kelvin cosmic microwave background added to the back lobe noise of the antenna, and the performance of the antenna is measured in gain to temperature ratio. The forward gain is, let me pick a number, 50 dB, 60 dB, but there's a certain amount of temperature of the antenna because the back lobe is looking at the hot earth underneath that antenna, 290 degrees Kelvin, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, if you know what I mean. So there's always some noise from the antenna space, and the preamplifier you use in front of your receiver has got a certain amount of noise. So every signal you ever want to listen to is always competing with noise. Let me drop. The nice thing about a signal, if I got a pure signal coming out of my signal generator, and I'm now plugging it through my receiver, and if it's a ham radio receiver, I could set the IF bandwidth at 5 kilohertz if I want to listen to AM, set it at 1.5 kilohertz if I want to listen to sideband, I could set it at 250 hertz of bandwidth if I want to listen to CW. In theory, I can go down to 10 hertz if I wanted to listen to CW and I want to reject everybody. In theory, I could use a digital signal processor in my IF strip, which has a 10 hertz bandwidth. I could do that. I could hear some beautiful Morse code with that. When I change the bandwidth of the receiver, the signal I'm listening to, if it's a pure tone signal, the signal comes through the broadband filter, the narrowband filter, it comes through all of those filters absolutely identical if I've done a good engineering job. So the bandwidth of the filter and the strength of the signal does not change. That's the good news about the signal. Let me drop it. But noise has got a very different characteristic. Noise is broadband. The noise coming into that antenna on 20 meters. Whether I listen to it at 14, 14.1, 14.5, 15, 21 megs, no matter what frequency I listen to it, the noise will look the same. It's broadband. Therefore, when it comes to rating noise power, rate noise power in spectral density, they call it, how many dBm per megahertz or per kilohertz, as I listen to a broader bandwidth filter, listen to a receiver, the broader filter is going to hear more noise. The narrow filter will hear less noise. So that if I use a more and more narrow filter, when I'm listening to a signal that looks like it's buried in noise, if I make the filter narrow enough, the signal keeps coming through with no change. The noise gets weaker and weaker because I'm listening to less and less of it as I use a more and more narrow bandwidth. Let me drop. So as long as the signal you're listening to has a slow enough drift rate, you know the exact frequency it's on, as long as my receiver has no drift, I can then take a 10 hertz filter, put the signal I'm listening to in the middle of the IF filter of that receiver, and listen to that 10 hertz bandwidth signal. And I've now eliminated a tremendous amount of noise by using a narrow bandwidth. So you give me a narrow enough bandwidth, you give me a signal that's steady enough in frequency, and a receiver that's steady enough in its tuning characteristics, there is no signal weakness that I cannot listen to. You make the signal weaker and weaker, I use a more and more narrow filter, more and more gain maybe, more and more narrow filter, and I'll continue to listen to the signal, no matter how weak it is. Well, because the signal is getting weak, I'm now going to turn up the gain. I'm going to use two preamplifiers instead of one preamplifier to build up the amplitude of the signal. But the only way I'm going to get that signal above the noise is I've now got to make the bandwidth of the receiver very narrow. I keep making a gain. You keep letting me do that. There is no signal that I cannot listen to, no matter how weak the signal is. If the signal is steady enough in frequency and my receiver is steady enough and you've given me a narrow enough filter by way of digital signal processing, for instance, you cannot name a signal that's too weak that you cannot listen to. Ain't that crazy? It's the truth. Let me drop. But there's a great big catch. You give me a filter that's only 10 hertz wide. Let me go to the extreme. Give me a filter that's 1 hertz wide, and that does exist. And in space environments, they sometimes do that. In theory, you can listen to a signal with a 1 hertz wide filter. And by way of the dynamic signal analyzer called 3561, I think it is, by Hewlett-Packard, I can make a filter on that so-called receiver 1 millihertz wide, a thousandth of a hertz wide, can be tuned with that receiver when you set the dials on the front panel correctly. A millihertz of bandwidth, something you very rarely hear about. A thousandth of a hertz of bandwidth. Now, let me go down to a 1 hertz bandwidth, for instance. And if I now turn on that signal, it comes through the 1 hertz filter, beautiful. Somebody turns off the signal, and it turns out I'm going to hear that signal coming out of my receiver for the next half a second. The signal abruptly changed by going completely off, and yet the receiver comes out of my receiver for the next half a second because I'm using a 1 hertz filter. A 1 hertz filter is a high Q resonator. It's like a flywheel. You stop putting power into a flywheel, it doesn't stop instantaneously. It slowly slows down. A 1 hertz filter, it's gonna ring for at least half a second. As you're about to see, if I modulate, if I'm now trying to speak into a microphone and putting that signal onto that transmitter, and you think you're going to listen to it with a 1 hertz filter, not a chance. Let me drop this. If you are sending Morse code through a 1 hertz filter, you could send approximately 1 board per second. In other words, you could decide to send a dot, that's a board, or a dash, that's a board, and you can send one of those dots or one of those dashes per second because of the ringing time of your filter. So you allow the filter to become narrow enough so that the signal-to-noise ratio of your super weak signal is desirable to you. That's the good news. The bad news is the data rate you can send through that filter is approximately the bandwidth. I'm rounding up the numbers. You give me a 1 hertz filter, I can only give you 1 cycle per second of data. You give me a 50 hertz filter, I can give you 50 bits per second. filter, and I can send pretty good audio through that AM modulated audio, plus or minus 2.5 kilohertz of audio, if you know what I mean, upper sideband, lower sideband of AM. So the data rate that you can send through an ideal filter in a receiver is directly proportional to the bandwidth of the filter. Let me drop. And how weak a signal you can listen to is the inverse proportion of the bandwidth of the filter. So that when Voyager is out there at 12 billion miles, where it is right now, three times the distance to Pluto, the signal they're getting from that probably 10-watt transmitter, 12 billion miles away, when you're listening to it with a 245-foot diameter parabolic dish at Goldstone, California, carefully aimed and carefully tuned to that particular frequency, you get a desirable signal-to-noise ratio when you use a 50-hertz filter. Therefore, they can only send 50 bits per second through that filter. They command Voyager, hey, tell me what you're seeing out there, but feed it to me slowly, feed it to me at 50 bits per second, because I've got to use the 50 hertz filter. They intend to listen to Voyager until the year 2022, when it's two or three times the distance out there that it is right now. You're going to get a signal that's 6 dB weaker. When the signal is 6 dB weaker, that's a 4-to-1 ratio, they're going to use the filter one quarter of the bandwidth they're using right now. They're probably going to go down to a 15 hertz filter. Let me drop. Goes that same number of watts of signal at a tremendously increased distance by the inverse square law is getting weaker. They can only listen to that signal above the noise if they use a more narrow filter. It might be a 15 hertz filter they're going to use in the year 2022. Therefore, they will tell Voyager, tell me whatever you want to say, but send it a little bit slower yet. Send it to me at 15 bits per second. So you can see the relationship. There ain't no limit to how weak a signal you can listen to in real-world conditions with ideal equipment if you use a filter that's narrow enough. And you can survive the data sending through that filter if the data is sent slow enough. If you take that 50 hertz filter that they're using right now to listen to Voyager, and if something goes wrong and Voyager starts sending the data at 1,000 bits per second instead of 50 bits per second, almost all of that data, by the laws of Fourier transform, Fourier series, all of that data will fall outside of the filter. And they will hear none of it. They will hear the carrier. They will not hear the data. If Voyager starts transmitting the data too fast, the only way they can hear the data that fast is use a broader filter. The broader filter will allow them to hear less noise, more noise, the broader filter. The more noise means that the noise will cover up the signal they want to listen to, and they'll get nothing. The beautiful design of Voyager, let me drop, is that it's got enough knobs on it, digitally speaking. You could call it a digitally controlled receiver, transmitter. They can command it whatever data rate they want. And as the signal gets weaker and weaker because they're greater and greater distance, they're going to tell it to slow down more and more. And your next question is going to be, when they're listening to that signal downlink at 8,500 megahertz, and they're using a filter 150 hertz wide, or 50 hertz wide, how the hell do they do that? If you start tuning across the band with a 50 hertz filter, and you're trying to find the signal that's somewhere around 8,500 megahertz, you wouldn't stand a chance. Except for the next piece of beauty of that design is that the downlink signal is not a function of the local crystal oscillator that's heating up, closing, heating up, cooling off, aging, and doing whatever. The voltage they're getting out of the nuclear power supply is slowly going down. The frequency that they would be transmitting would slowly go to a lower frequency, probably. Except the frequency that Voyager is transmitting is not determined by Voyager. Drop. The signal it transmits to us, Voyager downlink, is a function of the Goldstone uplink. Goldstone is sending them a signal at, I don't know the exact number, maybe it's 9.0 gigahertz. But the electronics on Voyager takes the uplink signal, divides it by the ratio of 240 over 221. That is the exact ratio of uplink frequency to downlink frequency. Very carefully chosen number. 240 over 221. That's the deep space network. Therefore, every hertz of the signal you get back down is a function of some number of hertz you sent up. It uses the uplink signal as the reference as to what it transmits back down. Because you know the Doppler shift, because you know the velocity, you know exactly how much the signals are going to be shifted. Because it's using your uplink signal as a reference, you know exactly what frequency you're going to get down to the nearest millihertz. You know exactly where to tune the receiver. Ain't that a beautiful system? And that was a 1980 design. The Deep Space Network. Fantastic. Somebody had a lot of smarts when they came up with that one. That's some of what's going on here. Great piece of hardware. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Beautiful explanation, Dick. Very good. And also, I'd like him to know that this will be recorded on the amateur TV. No, what's it? Amateurradio.tv. I know he knows about that website, so he'll be able to possibly record that information so that he could bring it into the teacher and have that played back for him. Or maybe he can let the teacher go to the website. That would probably be better. But very good. Good questions tonight. All right, we'll go over to Paul. That's it for the mailbag. And we'll see what's going on this Easter weekend. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Comment on the bits per second for Voyager.
Okay, you're the next guy coming up. We're about to get the space report from Paul. And we're getting a little bit of noise out of your signal tonight, Paul. Maybe you've got to aim the antenna a little bit differently. But you sound good. So go right ahead with your question. Endor your space report, WS2N. Who is about to give us space report number 194 of the series that began a couple of years ago. You got a phone, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, according to the Voyager website, they still say they're transmitting at 160 bits per second normally, and 1.4 kilobits per second for playback of the high-rate plasma wave data. So they're down to 160, really, is the number that they're using. And, of course, it's in the X-band. Uplink is different, though. Uplink is S-band, 16 bits. That's 1/6, 16 bits per second for uplink. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to make some guesses as to what's going on here, Paul. The uplink is only 16 bits per second. Because Voyager, the receiver on Voyager doesn't have anywhere near the sensitivity as the receiver at Goldstone listening to the downlink. I'm pretty sure it is a crystal diode mixer front end receiver. The reason for that is because there's a lot of risk involved in putting a low noise preamplifier on a piece of electronics like Voyager. The good news about a low noise preamplifier is it can make you 10, 15, 20 dB more sensitive. Because you've now amplified that signal before you put it into the lossy mixer that does the downlink, the down conversion for the super heterodyne to get into the first IF. A mixer front end has got about an 8 dB noise figure, a good one. And it's got to be after a band pass filter. So they probably got 8, 9, 10 dB of loss before the first IF stage of amplification. Let me drop. Whereas if you had a real good low noise preamplifier, you could have 20 decibels more sensitivity. That's the good news. The bad news about a low noise preamplifier is that if it fails, instead of giving you 20 dB of gain, it can give you 30 dB of loss. And a low noise preamplifier at X-band in 1977, when that thing was issued, when that thing was launched, and it was probably a 1970 design, the best low noise preamplifier in 1970 was an extremely delicate transistor. You breathe on it, so to speak, and the electrostatic voltage it picks up would wipe out the gas-fed front end. So there's a zillion ways a low-noise preamplifier can fail. A hell of a lot of space hardware does not have a low-noise preamplifier because of its possibility of failing and completely making your receiver completely dead. So for safety reasons, they use a mixer front end. As such, even though they got 10 kilowatts or 50 kilowatts of power that they can transmit at Goldstone with a zillion dB gain, 240-foot diameter antenna, because that receiver is so insensitive, they've got to send the data slow.